Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is February 25th, 2013. The next two shows both come from our live show on February 14th. I'm sorry that it took a while to get them out. I know you've been on the edge of that seat. I had a lot of work to do to get ready for the 2013 New Hampshire Liberty Forum, which I just got back from yesterday. And it was a huge success. I look forward to talking to you about it and sharing all of the content that was created at that event. Some awesome stuff. One show in particular that I'm really excited about. But that's all coming up soon. I wanted to rush these two shows out. I know that's a strange thing to say about two shows that are 11 days old. But I hope you enjoy these next two shows. They were both built off of listener questions. One from an email and one from an actual phone call, which led to a pretty interesting discussion. Today, we're going to do the email. Came from a ninth grader and provided us an opportunity to explore in more depth, or at least from a different angle than we have before, the history and legal issues around compulsory schooling in the United States. So I hope you find this interesting. Always look forward to your feedback. Go to that website of ours, schoolsucksproject.com. Register if you haven't. Make an account. Get involved in our forum. Start yourself a little group or look at the groups that are already there and join one of them. And please subscribe to our YouTube channel. One very exciting thing, with the help of a guy named J.J. Schlesinger, who you've actually heard. He's been a co-host on the live show before. We live streamed pretty much the whole event. Few technical challenges. That goes without saying. But there's actually a video up on our YouTube channel of Cory Doctorow. The title of his speech was Freedom Means Free Code. And it's doing very well. Already has over 1,000 views. I just posted it a little more than 24 hours ago. So if you get some free time, check that out. More stuff coming very soon. A lot of stuff coming very soon. Thanks for listening. Take care.
There are a lot of very fine first-rate minds in here. But by my experience in this building, none of you have ever been taught the tools by which your mind can work easier on the information you get from the outside world. We concentrate on ideas and the structure of how people think. So memorizing things and writing it down on a test never happens in here at all. It doesn't happen once. You may have tests, but they won't have anything to do with paper and pencil. And you begin to understand how to use these tools, you will have taken a giant step forward to being a powerful, independent human being.
Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Live. Today is February 14th.
Ooh. Happy Valentine's Day, Brett.
Happy Valentine's Day.
What did you bring me?
I didn't bring anything. I did bring something to your work today, but it was not Valentine's Day related, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
I'm not a Valentine's Day celebrator.
No, neither am I. In fact, I made a post as such on Facebook earlier today, and just as I came in the studio tonight, I noticed my wife made a comment on it and was none too pleased with me. So,
what was it? What did you do?
Well, shall I read?
Yes.
Okay. Let's, okay.
And while we have time here, you know, in the chat, give us your thoughts about Valentine's Day. Are you doing something special? Did you spend some time in the, that special aisle of the drugstore that they set up for whatever holiday it is, filled with knickknacks related to that festivity, buying some things for your significant other?
Yeah.
Or did you not?
Wait. Now, what my post was, I would expect any wife of mine to whack me upside the head if I attempted to get all romantic with her to celebrate some dude getting beaten with clubs and beheaded. And later on, I said, yeah, it must be weird to be married to some creepy death and torture fetishist like so many dudes out there seem to be. And then her comment on my thread was, any husband of mine would understand that even a holiday celebrating brutality is still a good holiday to buy any wife chocolate.
Ooh, maybe the Whitman's sugar-free sampler. I looked for that today.
Yeah, I feel like that's that's not going to dig me out of this one.
So I had this cute, I would call it a cute idea for what I did today. Moving in with my significant other, my girlfriend.
Oh, right? Nice.
And that's happening this weekend.
Uh-huh.
So I thought it would be fun to meet her at work today with some flowers and candy and be like, this is not for Valentine's Day. Because it's not, because Valentine's Day is stupid.
Yeah.
I think. And if I'm offending anyone in the chat, please let me know.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to, but I'm not into it. I think this is our second or third, maybe our third one that's gone. The day has just passed unmentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking about her today, mm-hmm. and she called me, you know, and said, mm-hmm. meet me at work. And I wanted mm-hmm. to give her some money because I was carrying a lot of money with me.
Oh.
And that makes me nervous because I lose everything.
Oh.
You know, like anything that's smaller than my fist will say.
Okay.
Very hard to keep track of. So I use that as an excuse to do this exchange, which I thought was a nice thing to do. So mm-hmm. she was like quasi amused by it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like wasn't like, oh, that's really clever and funny. And but it was
she's
okay.
like, how dare you embarrass me with these at my workplace?
I did. I said, I'm sorry if this is embarrassing.
Okay. Did she hide them in her trunk?
No. I bought them and then I bought a vase for them and said she can put them on her desk. And she thought that it would make like for an extra kind of rejecting gesture if she just smashed it in the parking lot right in front of me. So glass broke and then the flowers just lied there in a puddle of flower water. And she turned and walked in. I'm sure it's something that we can work out later. Anyway, what I wanted to do on the show, got email from a listener who said he was a 15-year-old freshman in high school. And I'm going to share it with you. And I would love your participation in this one if you want to put it into the chat. But here is the email. Hey, Brett, I'm a 15-year-old guy in ninth grade in public school, and I wanted to ask you a question. So if all people in America are supposedly guaranteed the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, how is it not considered unconstitutional, in quotes, for kids to be forced to go to school? I do not want to go to school. So isn't that infringing on my liberty and pursuit of happiness? I'd appreciate feedback. Oh, man, that breaks my heart just a little bit. Because I don't know where this young guy is at in his development. I don't know how much of the show he's heard. I don't know if he maybe just stumbled across the website through the Facebook page or something like that. So where to start? We have this guy, Lysander Spooner, right? I believe you named a child after him. What is he known for?
His seminal work was called Constitution of No Authority, right?
Right. And the basic...
And by seminal, I mean a thing that everyone talks about, but no one's actually read.
I've never read it. But I know that the two main points of it are, or the idea is that either the Constitution left the door open for the federal government to become what it is today, or even in his day. Because he was talking about, you know, the expansion and the corruption of the U.S. federal government in the latter half, the last couple decades of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And that ties into our public school discussion, because that was certainly in the works by then in a lot of places in the United States. Or it was completely impotent as far as stopping it was concerned from states or governments doing what they do, which is to expand. So I looked it up. The word liberty is only mentioned in the main text of the Constitution one time in the preamble. And the Constitution itself, excluding the Bill of Rights, doesn't guarantee anybody anything. I mean, I guess what it tries to do is guarantee people's liberties by restraining the power of the federal government, which it did not do.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say it restrains. It delineates the functions of government.
Yeah, and that's kind of a Ron Paul theory.
And I guess to the extent that it restrains, it does say everything else that's not in here is left to other people.
Right.
Not you, government.
But, and when I guess restrain would be more of a, maybe a conservative, paleo-conservative, Ron Paul, constitutional, libertarian kind of statement. Because if you actually read the Constitution, I'm surprised that this student, being a ninth grader, has ever even heard of it. Where would he have ever talked about it? I'm sure they don't read it in school.
I remember having to memorize the preamble to the Constitution. Yeah, but the only other things like that we had to read and learn were the Declaration of Independence and Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
Memorize them or read them?
Memorize them.
Yeah, just wrote, not really breaking it down. Analyzing what each word means, like indivisible, in the Pledge of Allegiance,
right?
Indivisible, I used to say.
Yeah, four score. I remember, like, what's a score?
Yeah, that blew my mind. Yeah,
like, what does that even mean?
So, a lot of the language that comes out of the schools about the Constitution bothers me, because people do talk as if that's where their rights come from, that's how their rights are protected. And history has proven that just simply not be the case. And Spooner talked about this at this point, you know, 130 years ago. I think the figure we gave before, and I forget where I saw it, I can try to put it in the show notes for this if I can find it, it was 1 in 6 people have some education after government school in history. So there is certainly a lot of confusion out there. I thought about how does this work in the adult world, right? So I just put in compulsion as far as like forced attendance is concerned. I wound up looking at court-mandated alcohol and drug treatment
right.
through AA and NA. And for those of you who don't know, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous both use these 12-step programs that have a pretty heavy emphasis on like getting God involved in your recovery. And
it's very much a cult, I feel.
Well, that's certainly not for everybody. But they say, you know, the first step with any problem is admitting that you have a problem, which I certainly agree with. But then very quickly, these steps get, I don't want to say the spiritual, like very specifically into God. I think there's been a lot of rationalizing in AA as it's become a more modern and rational world that it's they change God to higher power. It can be something of your understanding. And NA works pretty much the same way. But I looked into court cases on the issue of forced attendance because a lot of times if you get, say, a DWI, you will be given a court mandate to go to something like 2 or 3 months of AA.
Yes.
But is that a violation of the First Amendment if AA has this religious component that you have to be exposed to it? So it seems like the court's overwhelming, regardless of time, because I think the decisions that I looked at spanned over 20 years, and I don't want to get into the finite details of that, but it's boring. But in the adult world, compulsory attendance was considered to be, just to go back to the listener's question, unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't apply to kids.
Well, it's not... So the attendance is not compulsory, right? Because there's an alternative to the going to AA, which is that you could go to jail for however many days.
That is true.
Right.
And now there are probably, I mean, there are things that have kind of come up to fill the secular demand left by addicts who are atheists.
Yeah.
So there are other options. There's counseling options. There's other treatment programs. Or, yeah, I mean, you could refuse whatever the court says and you could go to jail. But the interesting thing that got me thinking, certainly something we've talked about before, is that the reason why courts ruled it unconstitutional as a violation of the First Amendment was because of the religious component. So could you make an argument that government school is pushing a religion? What's the definition of a religion? It's certainly pushing a faith.
Sure.
You know? And I think that that would be an interesting experiment. I'm not suggesting that our, you know, 15-year-old goes and tries this on his own without doing research. I highly recommend the site schoolsurvival.net. You know, there's forums there. And get involved on our site, too, and you know, post whatever questions or whatever you're thinking about there. It's school-survival.net. And there is quite a number of resources there. Maybe after we take a break, I'll take a closer look at the site and we can get into some of this stuff. But obviously, you know, back to the court decisions on mandated attendance in alcohol and drug treatment programs, it's a different set of rules for kids and adults. But I was interested to see if somebody could push the envelope with that religious piece of it.
I mean, they pledge allegiance to the flag every day.
Yeah, that's idol worship. Definitely an example of idol worship. And even instead of making the school the claim that the pedagogy in the school is religious, you could say that it's against your religion. Certainly, if you're a Quaker, right, it would be against your religion. So there might be an argument that you could make that way if doing things on a constitutional basis is what you're interested in.
But yeah, but then they'll tell you, well, it's not like we're not requiring you to come to this school. You could go to some other school then.
Yeah, and it's very hard to speak about this in general terms because from state to state, there are different requirements. Some states have very, very rigid homeschooling requirements. Some states are very, very loose about that. I'm sure somebody could put in our chat in all caps if they wanted to, you know, I live here, the laws are pretty loose, or I live here, we've looked into it, the laws are pretty strict.
Yeah, even in California, the worst place, there's not a rule in place that says if you homeschool, you must pray to our idol.
Yeah.
Right. But it's not there.
Didn't you say you went to some kind of homeschooling meeting and that was the first thing they did, though?
I didn't go to one. It was They had an education expo here in town a week or two ago.
At that Liberty Academy?
Yes. Yeah. And my wife went and she brought home a bunch of literature. And there's a piece of literature from this homeschooling co-op organization that spans the entire state.
Yeah.
And within the first few pages of the book, it had a section that said, well, what happens at our meeting? And it says, oh, each of the families takes turns leading the group in Pledge of Allegiance and prayer and, you know, other kinds of things.
So that's not
but,
for everybody.
Yeah, the first thing at every single one of these meetings, praying to the idol of statism. It makes me wonder, what's the point? To me, that's the first reason to get out of there.
Yeah.
Not the first thing that you replicate.
Yeah, so that's definitely something that's oozed out of the schooling paradigm. But going back to where our questioner is asked as far as his development or his understanding of these ideas, you know, we've talked a lot on this show over the years about how government schooling and, you know, not to be confused with education, which is completely different, is an anti-freedom institution. And this is a conversation that I had with both the high schoolers that I talked to recently, is that you don't hear a lot of conversations in the mainstream media or even in mainstream political dialogue where people are really having thoughtful conversations about trying to balance their needs for liberty and autonomy with their needs for safety and security. Safety and security are what the priorities are. And Sam, the girl I talked to, who has the YouTube channel, Liberty Queen, she was saying that basically the message is don't worry about freedom as long as you're safe. So I did want to share something from a John Taylor Gatto piece called The Tyranny of Compulsory Schooling. And this goes back to the origins of this system. The government schools that we have in the United States today came from, originated in a very unfree place at a very unfree time, which was Central Europe in the first half of the 19th century. Now, I was actually talking to a couple people about Sigmund Freud the other day, who we bashed on this show before as being kind of a quack. But one thing that I would say to Freud's credit is, considering where he was, even though he was on the other end of that century in Central Europe, for him to start talking to people about what's going on inside them, that was like pretty revolutionary considering where he was and when he was, when the MO for most people was, you know, shut up, do what you're told. Here's a uniform and a rifle, you know, to say, like, let's do self-exploration. Pretty revolutionary, even though he had those ideas of, you know, exploring the subconscious certainly didn't originate with him. He popularized them through his nephew. But yeah, I mean, that was Central Europe at that time. Their philosophy also became the prevailing philosophy in the United States in the 20th century, the collectivism. So Gatto writes, by 1919, Prussian philosophy had given the world its first laboratory of compulsory schooling. That same year, Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, a story of a German intellectual who fabricated a monster out of the parts of dead bodies. Compulsory schooling was the monster she had in mind, emblemized in the lurking destruction caused by a homeless, synthetic creature seeking its maker, a creature with the infinite inner pain that ambiguous family brings. I never knew that. I wonder if he's being somewhat presumptuous there. I heard Dr. Frankenstein was based on Ben Franklin.
Well, I never heard any such thing.
Yeah, because Franklin was, at the time, he was considered to be like a mad scientist with some of the stuff that he had done, and that's even where the name came from. But I've never heard Gatto's take on that before. I think that's interesting.
Wait, Frankenstein came from Ben Frank? Oh, Frank. Franklin Frankenstein.
Yeah. Okay. But he was German. So you can't have a German Franklin. You've got to have a Stein.
Right. It's kind of like when I call you Brettenstein.
Yep. In the 19th century, ties between Prussia and the United States were exceedingly close, a fact unknown these days because it became embarrassing to us during the World Wars and was so removed from the history. And so it was removed from the history books. American scholarship during the 19th century was almost exclusively German at its highest levels. This is true. The PhD system in the United States was Prussian in origin. Another fact conveniently absent from popular history. From 1814 to 1900, more than 50,000 young men from prominent American families made the pilgrimage to Prussia and other parts of Germany to study under its new system of higher education based on research instead of teaching. 10,000 brought back PhDs to a then uncredentialed United States, preempting the most available intellectual and technical work. Prussian education was the national obsession among political leaders, industrialists, clergy, and university people. In 1845, the Prussian emperor was even asked to adjudicate the boundary between Canada and the United States. Virtually every founding father of American compulsory schooling went to Prussia to study its clockwork classrooms firsthand. Horace Mann's seventh annual report to the Boston Committee of 1844 was substantially devoted to glowing praise of the Prussian accomplishments and how they should become our own. Victor Cousin's book on Prussian schooling was the talk of our country about the same time. When only a quarter century later, Prussia crushed France in a brief war and performed the miracle of unifying Germany, it seemed clear that the way to unify our immigrant classes was through Prussian schooling. So this institution is something that groups who seek power, groups who seek control, ever since it was first heard about in the United States, they wanted to grab and they wanted to use. And some of it might have been with the best intentions. Horace Mann was, more of a religious guy. He was certainly a politician as well. He's often considered to be the father of American education. Had political as well as religious aims for how the schools should steer society. It was half a century later when the reformers took over, people like Dewey and the Columbia Teachers College guys, Edward Cubberley, all these guys who were, interestingly enough, being funded by like the Rockefeller Foundation to collectivize society. I think for the academics, for the people like Dewey, it was more with socialist intentions, like wanting to make this socialist utopia in society. While, you know, the people who are funding it, all of these big foundations, had more of this top-down control attitude or about the importance of the schools. So, you know, this continued right into the 20th century. Have you ever heard of the Oregon Compulsory School Act?
No.
It relates to what we were talking about because I think it was in the early 1920s, and it was actually determined to be unconstitutional because what they wanted to do in Oregon, it was the Democratic governor and some labor organization and the Ku Klux Klan, right? Speaking of groups that want to use the controlling institution of school to their own purposes. It might have been a Protestant organization, actually, also working with the Democratic governor and the Ku Klux Klan to drive Catholics out of Oregon. Mm. So what they wanted to do was shut down all of the parochial schools through these laws, but they say it was forced attendance in public school. So that was the early 20s, but I thought we could also, let me check our chat real quick. Here in Utah, we have to file an affidavit to homeschool.
So I discovered here in New Hampshire, it's not as bad as I thought. What I had understood was that you have to keep some kind of records mm-hmm. of everything that you're doing and do this with an accredited school.
Yeah.
Of some kind. Well, what I didn't realize is that the people that you do this with, they don't actually have to turn that information over to the government. So this is basically a mass of evidence that you are compiling
yeah.
yourself that you can use to defend yourself if they ever drag you into court for not educating your kids.
Okay.
But it's not something to where like you have to file paperwork with the government every year or anything like that.
Yeah.
Just if some busybody neighbor starts accusing you and then they file charges against you or, you know, something like that occurs.
What I found was I used to work with that boy up in Bow, the conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
This is what, you know, reinvigorated my interest in the moon landing and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the stories of this guy. Do you ever get to go back and hang out with him?
No, I actually haven't seen him in almost a year, so I should check in with his parents and see how he's doing. Mm. The funniest story that I'll share with you about this young man, he was 9, and he was reading me this account of a woman who had been harassed by some kind of alien being, and possibly impregnated.
Oh!
He had this cadence that I found very interesting, where sometimes he would get excited, and his voice would get very high, and he's reading to me. And I guess I didn't realize how detailed the webpage was about this supposed encounter. And he says, and then it touched her on the vagina. That was interesting.
Like, excellent, Borat.
So when I started working with him, I felt like we should do what he wants. But I have to be on my toes at every stage in this to see how are we going to make it look like this activity is something that could be fit into the state standards. Like we could say, oh, we did this, but it satisfies standards this, this, and this. And I mean, I know what the standard, I know things just have to be nebulous enough. Like, I don't know what the standards are, but to be able to say this satisfies for, you know, third grader state standards X, Y, and Z. But then I met with somebody from the school and it turned out to not be that restrictive at all. I could basically do whatever I wanted. So they didn't care what I was doing because it wasn't their problem. I mean, that's how I felt. And honestly, the guy that I met with, who was the representative from the school, was very nice and very caring. And I just think that that would be the nature of a bureaucracy like that, out of sight, out of mind. So as long as they have something checked off on paper to say schooling is happening, then it didn't seem like, in that case anyway, in that district, that there was any more inquiry than that. But, you know, that's the thing, too. It's really hard to make very clear rules or very clear guidelines or give very clear advice about this, because I could say something about, you know, whatever county we're in New Hampshire. But if you're in Illinois or you're in California, it could be something completely different. You could get arrested for something that's okay here. There's just so much inconsistency that it's very hard to understand clearly what your path should be, depending on whether you're a parent who wants to homeschool or you're a kid who wants to get out of school. So one of the things, some homework that I guess I should have done before the show, is I should have found out where this boy who wrote to me, where he lives. But that would be my first piece of advice. Find out, you know, some of the laws where you are as far as schooling is concerned. Because I really don't think, I think if you bring, as a 15-year-old freshman in high school, if you bring your constitutional argument to the school board, they'll be like, oh, that's adorable.
Yeah.
We were talking about the history of compulsory education in America. Certainly familiar ground, but I wanted to try and add some new detail that we haven't really gotten into on this show before to try and answer the question of a listener in... He didn't say where he was. It really would have been helpful for me to know, and I should have asked. But he said, I'm a 15-year-old guy in ninth grade in public school, and I wanted to ask you a question. So if all the people in America are supposedly guaranteed the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, how is it not unconstitutional for kids to be forced to go to school? I do not want to go to school, so isn't that infringing on my liberty and pursuit of happiness? Well, there's a lot to unravel. Right. There's a lot of vocabulary in that. There's a lot of preconceptions in that. And I didn't really know what kind of exposure this listener had had to the show, or if they even are a listener to the show. They could have just stumbled across our website. I mentioned schoolsurvival.net as a good resource. They link to us as one of their allies, which I appreciate.
Oh, do we have an alliance? Or like a rebel alliance, like in Star Wars?
That would be good, and that would probably be a good... I should look at who else their allies is.
I'll be Chewbacca.
Our allies are. I want to be the guy... I know he wasn't part of the alliance, but I guess, you know, the people with Jabba the Hutt, they were... I started recording this, and now we're not even talking. Real quick. Real quick.
Short tangent.
Everybody who was involved with Jabba the Hutt, they were part of the rebellion, too.
Sure.
They weren't on the side of the Empire.
Right.
Right. But we always just kind of see them as like,
they're like the individualist rebellion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would want to be the guy with the ears and he had to wrap them around his head. Remember that guy?
What would you do with that much ear?
I don't know. I feel like I would like wave them around, like jiggle them.
Huh.
But think about what, I don't know. But he has this great line in Return of the Jedi when Luke says, you will take me to Jabba now. And he goes, I'll tackle the Jabba now.
You're referring to Bib Fortuna, I believe is his name.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I didn't realize that was an ear so much as it was just like a giant worm thing coming out of his head.
If anybody knows, can you put it in the chat? This is something.
My favorite line of his is, Le Jabba no Bada.
He does say that, too. Yeah. Anyway. But I like it how he does with his finger.
Yeah.
He goes, I'll take a Jabba now. We can do.
We can edit that out.
Yeah. That's fine. So, history of compulsory education started in Massachusetts, and I wanted to just give a quick history and also let people know how soon the opposition came. As we might have mentioned before, people were really kind of in shock about this idea of turning over education itself to the state. People saw that in the time of Lysander Spooner to be quite the tyrannical move. So this is just some of the language from the early compulsory education laws. Massachusetts, fittingly, was the first state in 1852. It specified age range, some types of exemptions and penalties. It required school attendance between the ages of 8 and 14 years for a period of 12 weeks each year, and attendance was to be continuous for 6 weeks. The rest of the time could be made up at the convenience of the child or the family by dropping in at school perhaps one day one week and 3 days the next. If the parents were poor, the child was being otherwise educated, or if it suffered from ill health, it was to be exempted from the requirements of the law. And New York's followed shortly after in 1874. I'm thinking this is the language from the law. All parents and those who have the care of children shall instruct them or cause them to be instructed in spelling, reading, and writing, English grammar, geography, and arithmetic. And every parent, guardian, or other person having control and charge of any child between the ages of 8 and 14 years shall cause such child to attend some public or private day school at least 14 weeks in each year. So that's pretty loose compared to what we have today. And, I mean, certainly there were a lot of good intentions at both phases of public education. The first one with Horace Mann in the middle of the 19th century, and the next one with John Dewey and the Columbia Teachers College guys and all the foundation-funded guys at the beginning of the 20th century. This goes on to say the Oregon Compulsory Education Act, but before we get to this, as these bureaucracies continue to exist, people find ways to abuse them. And that's what we saw with the Oregon Compulsory Education Act, passed in 1922, required with certain exemptions that every person having control of a child between 8 and 16 years of age send him to a public school in the district where he resided for the entire period which the school was in session. This represented a considerable acceleration in coercion and was successfully disputed in 1925 in court. So this is I'm reading this from honestedu.org. This is a website that I think people should definitely bookmark as a resource. Opposition to compulsory education. Compulsory education laws did not get passed easily or without opposition. In fact, all the so-called principles of American education, free, universal, non-sectarian, compulsory, public support, and public control, have been bitterly fought over in this country, and none of them perhaps more bitterly than public support and control and compulsory attendance legislation. The fact that education in this country began as a local interest and activity caused long and stubborn resistance to the centralized public support and control, and the belief that compulsory attendance legislation was an invasion of the parental function and the liberty of parents, and delayed the development of that principle, the acceleration process. And of course, the educational liberty takes another hit again later in the 20th century with the formation of the U.S. Department of Education, and how they try to sort of trickle down funding to state departments of education, and that's how they get them under the control of one centralized bureaucracy. And I hope the person who asked this question is starting to realize, if they had not realized it already, how foreign the concept of freedom or individual liberty or the pursuit of happiness is to this institution by, let's say, 1950. In the United States. I found this to be kind of tragicomic. Some of the retorts to the oppositions, the standard talking points against compulsory schooling. In 1872, B.G. Northrop, Secretary of the Connecticut State Board of Education, used his annual report to spell out the points of opposition to compulsory attendance legislation and his refutation of them. The report is excerpted here. So the first criticism of the compulsory school system is, such a law would create a new crime. To which Northrop replies, it ought to. To bring up children in ignorance is a crime that should be treated as such. As the most prolific source of criminality, it should be under the ban of legal condemnation and the restraint of legal punishment. Conflating the government school system with education. In other words, it could not happen anywhere else. Second objection to compulsory schooling, it interferes with the liberty of parents. To which Northrop, the Connecticut Secretary of Education, replies, again, it ought to. When they are incapacitated by vice or other causes for the performance of essential duties as parents, if the law may prohibit the owner from practicing cruelty upon his horse or ox, it may restrain the parent from dwarfing the mind and debasing the character of his child. The child has rights which not even a parent may violate. He may not rob his child of the sacred right of a good education. When a parent is disqualified by intemperance, cruelty, or insanity, society justly assumes the control of the children. The state should protect the helpless, and especially these, its defenseless wards, who otherwise will be vicious as well as weak. Okay, so there are certainly, I'm guessing, bad parenting was far more common then than it is today, at least I would like to think. And from the research that I've seen, parenting is moving in the right direction. But that pretty much became par for the course. And today, this has devolved to the point where people in these educational bureaucracies are basically telling parents that they have no business, in some cases, meddling in their children's education.
Yeah.
Some parents are being told not to teach their kids anything before they're actually sent to school.
Oh, right.
Because
right.
It will screw that with what the school wants to do.
Yeah. I was thinking about this earlier. Why is it that in a classroom, there's not a row of chairs in the back of the classroom for parents to just randomly come hang out? Or like, imagine, you know, like at my high school, there was, the school buildings were arranged. You know, this is California, so it's a little different than it is out in these parts, to where every classroom was its own individual outside entrance.
Yeah.
Like you didn't go from one classroom to another. You went outside of your classroom, walked down the sidewalk to another classroom.
Yeah, like Beverly Hills High.
Yeah, something like that. But you can imagine like a structure above all of those structures, like an observation deck where parents might just hang out, where they could look, you know, glass windows, and they could just look down at everything that's going on below, maybe with like, you know, little, you know, speakers that they could tune in to particular rooms so they could listen to what's going on, you know, something like that.
Yeah, that would be disruptive. That would be the argument against it. Is too it disruptive for the children?
Well, the second one I described would be the opposite of disruptive, right? Because no one would ever see.
I can't think of maybe the privacy of the teachers. I'm just trying to think their thoughts.
Sure.
Right? The first one, if parents could just walk into a class, they could easily dismiss that as being too disruptive. The other one, I would say the teachers' union would fight that tooth and nail, unfortunately. But, of course, this is like the same kind of inquisition as our questioner has. Like where he says to the authorities, isn't school a violation of my constitutional rights? Where he knows that's just going to get slapped down. I think you're kind of, you're asking a question we already know the answer to, right?
Yeah.
That accountability is not part of this.
But this is also an ongoing exercise of ours, is trying to come up with the perfect model for a school.
Right.
And maybe that's something to consider, is observation deck or observation chairs in the classrooms.
Of course, yeah, and in a more free school where there isn't that regimentation, there probably wouldn't be any problem with a parent just walking right into the middle of things.
Right.
You know, that would certainly disrupt this rigid routine of the public school where everyone's sitting in rows and the teacher is the only one who can talk unless somebody is called upon. All right, third opposition to compulsory schooling in the latter half of the 19th century. It arrogates new power by the government. The response? So do all quarantine and hygienic regulations and laws for the abatement of nuisances. Now, ignorance is as noxious as the most offensive nuisance and more destructive than bodily contagions. Now, this guy was pretty convinced that they had a system worked out that was actually going to educate people. And I will say, from what I have seen as far as some of the tests that kids were given in the late 1800s, what a 12 or 13-year-old, which is as far as most people went to school, was expected to know, it exceeds what most high school kids are expected to know today.
Does it exceed, or is it just different? Because isn't there more different stuff that people have to know now than they did before?
That is partially true, because there are new advancements, obviously.
What's a computer?
Science.
Yeah.
And there's a whole other century to deal with in social studies. But as far as, it seems like there was much more of a focus in schools then, that somebody would leave school at the age of 14, which is when most people did in the latter half of the 1800s, and they would know how to do stuff that would be useful in real life.
Could make a living for themselves.
Right. Yeah. Like they could write letters. They could deal with practical math. And those aren't
their checkbook.
So as far as the utility of the skills they would have, I would say that it exceeded today's standards. But this is, as you know, the unions got their hands on it, and they have to stretch what was 6 years into 12. Mm. It would make sense that what a 14-year-old was expected to know then is maybe more than what an 18-year-old he's expected to know today. Because, of course, as that 6 years of skills is stretched to 12 years, mm-hmm. and then all of this filler is put in, mm-hmm. Obviously, as the bureaucracy continues, the quality of it is going to go down as well. The next one, it is un-American and unadapted to our free institutions, criticism of compulsory school. Northrop responds, to put the question in the most offensive form, it may be asked, would you have policemen drag your children to school? I answer, yes, if it will prevent his dragging them to jail in a few years hence.
Because there's a difference?
Next objection. Compulsory education is monarchical in its origin in history. Northrop's response, erroneous. Before the Peace of Westphalia, before Prussia existed as a kingdom, and while Frederick William was only the elector of Brandenburg, Connecticut adopted coercive education, he calls it.
Wow.
Coercive education.
Coercive education.
I like that word coercive instead of government. All right, the next objection to the school system, attendance would be just as large without the law as it is now. So people were saying that just as many people, if this is education, just as many people, parents mostly, would be interested in having their children be educated, I would think. That's the argument. I don't know if I agree with that or not. I'm just kind of rewording what okay. the objection
they're
is.
They're saying whether it's mandatory or not, mm-hmm. just as many people would want it.
That's what the objection to the compulsion law is. And I don't know if that is true. I would think that especially back then when it was much more of an agrarian society that people would want their children as laborers.
Yeah. I don't see that that's an objection. And I also don't think it's true. I think as soon as you make something mandatory, fewer people are going to want it than otherwise would.
Yeah, because it goes into the other category of things in life. You can divide into two, voluntarily chosen or imposed.
And that's even abstracting away from changes that necessarily will occur in the product being delivered, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the basis of it being a forced thing. Like, immediately when it goes from voluntary to forced, it's probably not going to change very much, but then over time it degrades into this disgusting monstrosity, right?
Yeah, because why would it have to be?
So then, of course, you're going to want it even less than just the very same product, the only difference being voluntary versus coerced.
Ooh, we might be in agreement with Northrop here, though. Let's see how he responds. Okay. I'm thinking it might be a little more offensive than what you just said.
Okay.
So again, it was attendance would be just as large without the law as it is now. It may be so. But so far from being an objection, this fact is strong proof of the efficiency of that law, which has itself helped create so healthful a public sentiment. Were the law to be abrogated tomorrow, the individual and general interest in public education would remain. The same might be said that of Connecticut for more than 170 years after the adoption of a compulsory education system. So there you disagree. During all that period, a native of this state of mature age, unable to read the English language, would have been looked at as a prodigy. Still, in Connecticut, as well as in Germany, it was the law itself which greatly aided in awakening public interest and in fixing the habits, associations, and traditions of the people. Dang.
Fixing.
Still in Connecticut, as well as in Germany, it was the law itself which greatly aided in awakening public interest and fixing the habits, associations, and traditions of the people. And that
I'm unfamiliar with that particular history, but here's what I do know. Whenever government attributes changes to its own legislation, is that those changes were going on anyway, and government jumped on the bandwagon with its dictates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to take credit for the changes that were already occurring, even though what it was doing was actually hampering those changes, which would have been much quicker otherwise.
And I should really know the historical context of this, but I'm wondering what it was in the latter half of the 1800s that was creating an increase in the desire for education. I mean, I think people, what motivated people throughout most of colonial America as the French guy who came here, what was his name? De Tocqueville?
Yes.
Pointed out that it was a highly literate society and said that was the reason why the democracy in America seemed to work so well, is that people were educated. Mm. And we're talking before the institution of the first public education system
mm-hmm.
before Massachusetts adopted a compulsory school system. But, I mean, if you think about democracy in America up to that point, up to maybe 1820, the worst president was probably Adams. You know, there hadn't been any, like, no one had accepted any tyrants, really.
Yeah.
I think that it's possible that the system did work better. The best a system like this can work. And, of course, it can't really work for meeting the needs of individuals. But it wasn't not working to the point where somebody like, you know, Lincoln or Wilson or Teddy Roosevelt or Franklin Roosevelt was able to rise to power and abuse power as they did. So I'm going to read just a couple more paragraphs here quickly, and then we'll probably wrap this up. I'll take a look at the chat. Ooh.
Okay, folks, sorry about that. At that point in the show, something in the chat caught my attention. I was very excited about it, as you can tell, and we went off in a new direction, and you will hear what that new direction was in the very next show. But I just wanted to make sure that we had some closure with this topic. I did want to go back to that article that I was reading. The title of that article was Compulsory Attendance by Mary Kay Novello, and it was on honestedu.org. And we were going through, of course, the history of compulsory education, but I also wanted to deal with some of the legal background. So there is one subheading called court tests that I wanted to share with you. And then, of course, I can't, like I said in the show, I can't give any concrete advice about how one person goes about getting out of school legally, but I will put some resources in the show notes, and I will tell you about one right now in case you consume this podcast in a way where you do not look at or you cannot see the show notes that are posted on the website and should be available through iTunes as well, obviously. HSLDA.org, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, has a pretty thorough guide to the withdrawal from public school process. I will link to that specific page. You just put in your state and you can get details there. This is such a mess and so much inconsistency from state to state and place to place that, like I said, I'm really sorry that I can't provide more concrete across-the-board information. It's almost like it was designed to stop me from doing that. So anyway, let's go back to this compulsory attendance article. And like I said, the subheading is called Court Tests. In view of the fact that compulsory attendance legislation almost always faced stiff opposition from the willingness of people to accept the principle that the state should be given the right to interfere with the traditional authority of parents, it is little wonder that the matter was taken up by the courts. Perhaps the first case to test the constitutionality of this legislation took place in Ohio. The court decided in 1891 that the compulsory education law of 1877 was unconstitutional, virtually the same decision that has been made every time the question has been raised. However, the Ohio decision declared that the welfare of the minor child was so important that the state had the right to interfere with the freedom of the parents. More typical has been the decision that compulsory schooling benefits the community and the state. Losing the right to oversee the religious development of their children was bitterly resented by many parents, and the establishment of parochial schools was tolerated until the Oregon Education Act of 1922 declared, as mentioned earlier, that all children were to attend public schools. A Roman Catholic teaching order brought suit to have the law declared unconstitutional. This is the text from that. Those who favored the law hearkened back to the arguments used in building the common school ideal of the early 19th century. They claimed that the demands of citizenship required the state to see to it that all potential citizens be given appropriate training for their responsibilities, that the increase in juvenile delinquency followed upon an increase of numbers attending non-public schools, that attendance at a common school would prevent religious hostility and prejudice, and that instruction in American government and institutions for immigrant children could best be done when children of all classes and creeds attended school together. The crowning argument was made that loyalty to America could best be taught in public schools, and that if the law were declared unconstitutional, the state would have no means of prohibiting the teaching of subversive doctrines by Bolshevists, syndicalists, or communists in private school. How goddamn ironic. The prosecution argued, it is not seriously debatable that the parental right to guide one's child intellectually and religiously is a most substantial part of the liberty and freedom of the parent. The statute in suit trespasses not only upon the liberty of parents individually, but on their liberty collectively as well. It forbids them as a body to support private and parochial schools and thus give to their children such education and religious training as the parents may see fit, subject to the valid regulations of the state. While the court found some merit in the plea of the defendants, it sided with the plaintiffs, stating, as often heretofore pointed out, rights guaranteed by the Constitution may not be abridged by legislation which has no reasonable relation to some purpose within the competency of the state. The fundamental theory of liberty upon which all governments in the Union repose excludes any general power of the state to standardize its children by forcing them to accept instruction from public teachers only. The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations. More recently, in 1972, the United States Supreme Court decided in Wisconsin versus Yoder that Amish children could be exempt from compulsory education after the eighth grade. And I will provide some more links to the legal history of this issue if people are interested in pursuing that on their own. It's not super exciting territory for me personally, but I did want to make sure that despite some knowledge deficits on this area or as far as being able to give real specific information helpful to the person who asked this question, that we would try to provide something contextual. Now, I just wanted to end today with the last piece of what we were reading in the show, B.G. Northrup, the Secretary of Education in the state of Connecticut, the author's commentary. So this is what is written after all of those answers to the objections that Osborne and I went over during the show. Novello writes, perhaps the syntax of 1872 was so different from that of today that it has rendered the last two of Northrup's refutations beyond interpretation. But they would seem to argue against the points he was trying to make, especially his use of the word coercive. And just to refresh your memory, the last two refutations to arguments against compulsory education, the first argument against that Novello is referencing is compulsory education is monarchical in its origin and history, to which Northrop responds, common as this impression is, it is erroneous. Before the Peace of Westphalia, before Prussia existed as a kingdom, and while Frederick William was only the elector of Brandenburg, Connecticut adopted coercive education. The second objection is attendance would be just as large without the law as it is now, to which Northrop responds, it may be so, but this fact is strong proof of the efficiency of the law, which has itself helped create so healthful a public sentiment. Were the law to be abrogated tomorrow, the individual and general interest in public education would remain. The same might have been said of Connecticut for more than 170 years after the adoption of compulsory education. During all that period, a native of this state of mature age, unable to read the English language, would have been looked upon as a prodigy. Still in Connecticut, as well as in Germany, it was the law itself which greatly aided in awakening public interest in fixing the habits, associations, and traditions of the people. Novello concludes, in those two paragraphs, however, he clearly gave credit to Germany and Prussia before it as the model for government schools in the United States. Whatever their ambiguities, however, those ringing words of Northrop have formed the basis of the defense of compulsory education for some 125 years. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you are a home educating parent, please feel free to provide some feedback either in the comments for this episode or go to our home educators group and share with others what your process has been. Thanks again. Take care.